It is also more pleasant to ask a keen huntsman about his dogs, and a sports enthusiast about athletic contests, and a lover about beautiful people. A pious man devoted to sacrifice likes to narrate his dreams, and would gladly be asked as well about whatever he has achieved by making use of oracular sayings, sacred rites, or the favor of the gods. As for old men, even if the narrative is not exactly relevant, those who ask always do them a favor and set them willingly in motion. Nestor, son of Neleus, tell me truly, how did the son of Atreus die? Where was Menelaus? Or was he not in Achaean Argos? Asking many things at once and welcoming occasions for many words, not, as some do, compressing the answer into the bare necessity, and by driving replies into a narrow compass, depriving the old man's pastime of its sweetest part. In general, those who wish to give pleasure rather than pain put forward such questions as bring, in their answers, not blame but praise, and, from those who hear them, not hatred or resentment but goodwill and gratitude. So much, then, for questions. As for jesting, one who cannot handle it with caution and skill, at the right moment, must abstain from it altogether. For just as those who are on slippery ground fall down even if they only brush against it in passing, so in wine drinking, we stand precariously with regard to every occasion for talk that does not proceed in due form. Indeed, we are sometimes more provoked by jests than by outright abuse, partly because we often see abuse arising unwillingly, under the sway of anger, whereas a jest we set down as unnecessary, the deliberate work of insolence and malice. And in general, we grow more irritated conversing with composed, self-possessed people than with mere idle chatterers. For it is clear that in the case of a jest, artifice attaches to its very form, and that it is in fact an insult, contrived with premeditation. The man who plainly called someone a pickled fish seller abused him outright, but the one who said, "We remember you wiping your nose on your arm," made a jest of it. And Cicero, when Octavius, who was reputed to be from Libya, claimed while Cicero was speaking that he could not hear him, retorted, "And yet your ear is quite pierced." And Melanthius, being mocked by the comic poet, said, "You are paying me back a debt I never owed." Jests then bite more sharply, like barbed arrows that stay lodged longer, and the pleasure taken in their wit pains those who are mocked even as it delights the bystanders. For delighting in what is said, the bystanders seem to believe it and to join in dragging down the person it concerns. For a jest, according to Theophrastus, is really a reproach for a fault, disguised in form. Hence the hearer, out of his own suspicion, supplies what is left unsaid, as though he already knew it and believed it. Anyone who laughs and is delighted when, say, Theocritus said to a man suspected of stealing cloaks, who asked him whether he was going to dinner, that he was indeed going. But sleeping there, though, such a listener is no different from one who confirms the slander outright. That is why a man who jests out of tune infects the bystanders with malice as well, making them appear to share in his pleasure and join in the insult. It was reckoned one of the disciplines in noble Sparta to jest without giving pain and to bear being jested at. And if anyone who was being teased said, "Enough," the jester stopped at once. How, then, is it not difficult to find a jest that is actually pleasing to the one jested at, when even a harmless jest is a matter requiring no ordinary experience and skill? And yet it seems to me that, in the first place, jests that pain those who are actually guilty produce a certain pleasure and charm for those who are far removed from the slander. Xenophon, for instance, introduces that extremely ugly and extremely hairy fellow being jested at, in play, as the beloved of Sambolas. And you remember our friend Quietus, when he remarked that during his illness his hands had felt cold, Aufidius Modestus replied, "Well, but you have brought them home warm from your province." To Quietus himself, this gave laughter and delight, but for a thieving proconsul it would have been an insult and a reproach. That is why Socrates, when he challenged Critobulus, who was extremely handsome, to a contest of good looks, was playing, not mocking. And again, Alcibiades used to tease Socrates about his jealousy over Agathon. Kings, too, take pleasure in being spoken of as though they were poor men and commoners, just as the parasite, when jested at by Philip, said, "Am I not the one who feeds you?" For by attributing to someone faults that do not really belong to him, one throws into relief the good qualities that do belong to him. But there must be some good quality that indisputably and certainly belongs to the person. Otherwise, the opposite of what is said carries only a questionable insinuation. For the man who says of someone very rich that his creditors will soon come down on him, or who says that the water-drinking, temperate man is behaving drunkenly and getting intoxicated, or who calls the man who is generous, magnificent, and open-handed a skinflint and a penny pincher, or who threatens that the man who is powerful in advocacy and public life will be seized and hauled off in the marketplace. Such a man produces delight and a smile. So too Cyrus, in the respects where he was outdone by his companions, became gracious and charming when challenged to a contest in those very things. And when Ismenias was piping for a sacrifice, and the omens were not turning out favorable, a hired flute player took the pipes from him and played ridiculously. And when the bystanders found fault with him for it, and the sacrifice then proved favorable, he said, "This shows that playing the flute pleasingly is a gift from the gods." But Ismenias laughed and said, "No, while I was playing, the gods lingered on, taking pleasure in it. But eager to be rid of your playing, they accepted the sacrifice at once. Furthermore, those who name good qualities in things using words that are properly terms of reproach, when they do so playfully and gracefully, give more pleasure than those who praise straightforwardly. Indeed, those who reproach through complimentary terms bite more sharply, as when people call wicked men Aristides's and cowards Achilles's, or as in Sophocles' Oedipus, where Creon is called this man's faithful friend from the beginning. This, then, seems to be the converse counterpart of irony, applied to praise, and this device too Socrates employed, when he named Antisthenes' gift for befriending and bringing men together into goodwill, procuring, pandering, and pimping. And they called Crates the philosopher, who went into every house and was received everywhere with honor and kindness, the opener of every door. A charming jest is also produced by a reproach that in fact shows affection, as when Diogenes said of Antisthenes, "He it was who clothed me in rags and forced me to become a beggar and drove me from my house, a homeless wanderer." For he would not have been equally persuasive had he said outright, "He made me wise, self-sufficient, and blessed." And the Spartan, pretending to complain to the gymnasiarch who had supplied smokeless firewood, said, "Because of him we have not even been able to shed a tear." And the man who called someone who dined him daily a kidnapper and a tyrant, because for so many years he had not seen his own dinner table. And the man who says he has been plotted against by the king, robbed of his leisure and his sleep, having become rich from being poor. And so, too, if someone, turning it around, were to accuse Aeschylus's Cabiri of having made their household short of vinegar, just as they themselves had jokingly threatened. Such jests strike home more, having a sharper charm, yet in such a way as not to give offense or pain to those actually being praised. The man who is to use a jest gracefully must also know the difference between the fault and the pursuit, I mean between avarice and contentiousness on the one hand, and a love of music or of hunting on the other. For men are annoyed when jested at over the former, but take pleasure when jested at over the latter. Not unpleasantly, at any rate, did Demosthenes of Mytilene act when, having knocked on the door of a man devoted to singing and the lyre, and the man having answered and told him to come in, he said, "Only if you first tie up your lyre." But unpleasantly did the parasite of Lysimachus react when Lysimachus threw a scorpion made of wood into his cloak. Badly startled and jumping up, once he realized it was a joke, he said, "I too, O king, want to frighten you. Give me a talent." There are similar differences among most people concerning bodily features. Some laugh when jested at over having a hooked nose or a snub nose, as did Cassander's friend, who was not at all annoyed when Theophrastus said to him, "I marvel at your eyes, because they do not sing, though your nose provides the pitch." And Cyrus ordered the hook-nosed man to marry a snub-nosed woman, since the two would fit together well. But men are annoyed when jested at over a foul-smelling nose or mouth. And again, they bear jests about baldness calmly, but take unpleasantly to jests about blindness. Indeed, Antigonus himself used to jest about his own bad eye. And once, when he had received a petition written in large letters, he said, "Even a blind man could see this." Yet he put Theocritus of Chios to death, because when someone said to Theocritus, "If you come into the king's presence, you will be safe," Theocritus replied, "But you are telling me that this very thing, safety, is impossible." Leo of Byzantium, when Passiades said to him that his own eyes had caught an eye disease from him, replied, You reproach me with a bodily weakness, without seeing the retribution you carry on your shoulders, your son. For Pasiades had a hunchback son. Archippus, too, the demagogue of the Athenians, was angered when mocked by Melanthius for being hunchbacked. For Melanthius said that he did not stand at the head of the city but stooped over it. But some bear such things calmly and with moderation, as did the friend of Antigonus who, having asked for a talent and not received it, asked instead for an escort and guards, so that I might not be waylaid, he said, since I have ordered him to carry the talent on his own shoulder. So it is with regard to outward circumstances, because of the diversity involved, different people are annoyed at different things. Epaminondas, dining with his fellow magistrates, was drinking vinegar, and when they asked whether it was good for the health, he said, I don't know, but I do know that it is good for remembering one's fare at home. Therefore one must, with an eye to people's natures and characters, employ playful jests accordingly, trying to converse with each person pleasantly and without giving pain. Love, among other things, is highly variable, and where jests are concerned, some lovers are annoyed and vexed while others are delighted. One must know the right moment. For just as a breath of wind, at first, extinguishes a fire because of its weakness, but once the fire has grown, supplies it with fuel and strength, so love, while it is still budding and hidden, chafes and is vexed at those who reveal it. But once it has flared up and become manifest, it is fed and smiles upon the jests, swelling with them. Lovers are most delighted to be teased, in the presence of their beloveds, about the very fact of being in love, and about nothing else. And if it happens that they are in love with their own wives, or with a noble passion for beautiful young men, they take altogether great delight and pride in being teased about it in front of them. That is why Arcesilaus, when in his school one of the amorous students shared this remark with him, it seems to me that nothing touches anything, replied, then you don't touch this one either, pointing to one of the beautiful and youthful students seated nearby. One must also consider, further, who is present. For the things people laugh at when they hear them among friends and intimates, they take badly if said in front of others, in front of one's own wedded wife, or one's father, or one's teacher, unless what is said happens to be pleasing to those people too. For example, if someone is teased in the presence of his philosophy teacher about going barefoot or riding by night, or with his father listening about pettiness, or with his wife present about being indifferent to other women and being a devoted slave to her alone, as when Tigranes was asked by Cyrus, what would happen if your wife heard that you had been carrying baggage? But she will not hear it, he said. She will see it herself, being present. Jests are also made less painful when the speakers themselves share, in some way, in the very thing being mocked. As when a poor man jests about poverty, or a man of low birth about low birth, or a lover about love. For coming from one's like, such a thing seems to be not an insult, but rather a kind of playfulness. If it is not so, it provokes and pains. Take, for instance, the king's freedman, a man newly rich, who was crudely and arrogantly lording it over the philosophers dining with him, and who finally asked how it is that from both white and black beans alike a porridge equally green is made. Aridus's, asking in return how it is that from white and black leather straps welts equally red are made him get up thoroughly distressed. Amphias of Tarsus, who was reputed to have come from a gardener's stock, having jested at the governor's friend about his low birth, then immediately added, but we too have sprung from the same seed, and so raised a laugh. Wittily, too, the lyre player checked Philip's combination of late learning and meddlesomeness, for when Philip thought he was correcting him about notes and harmonies, the player said, may it never befall you, O king, he said, so badly indeed that you may know these things better than I do, for by seeming to mock himself, he corrected the king without giving pain. This is why some comic poets, too, are thought to take the sting out of their jesting by mocking themselves, as Aristophanes did with his own baldness and with Agathon's desertion, and Cratinus with his bottle concerning his own love of wine. One must be especially careful to watch for this, that the jest arise on the spot, out of what is actually present, in response to some question or bit of play, and not be dragged in from far off, as if brought on as a prepared set piece. For just as people bear more mildly the anger and quarrels that arise from within the symposium itself, Whereas if someone comes at them from outside and reviles and disturbs them, they regard him as an enemy and hate him, so too a jest has a share of pardon and of frankness if it takes its origin from what is present, growing up artlessly and without contrivance. But if it does not arise from the matter at hand, but is brought in from outside, it resembles a deliberate assault and an outrage. Such was Timagenes's remark to the man who induced vomiting. You are the author of this vile art, and his remark to Athenodorus the philosopher, if affection for one's offspring is natural. For ill timing and irrelevance to the matter at hand show insolence and ill will. These men, then, according to Plato, paid the heaviest penalty for the lightest of things, namely words. But those who know the right moment and observe it bear witness to Plato himself, that it is the work of a well-educated man to play in a tuneful and pleasing way. At Eleusis, after the mysteries, while the festival was at its height, we were dining at the house of Glaucias the orator. When the others had finished dining, Xenocles of Delphi, as was his custom, was teasing our brother Lamprias about his Boeotian gluttony. I, defending him and using the arguments of Epicurus against Xenocles, said, "Not everyone, my good man, makes the removal of pain the boundary and limit of pleasure. But for Lamprias it is even a necessity, since he glorifies the peripatetic walk and the Lyceum ahead of the garden, to bear witness indeed to Aristotle. For the man says that each of us is most inclined to eat around autumn, and he has given the reason, though I do not remember it." "Better," said Glaucias, "for we shall try to look into it ourselves once we stop dining." So when the tables were removed, Glaucias and Xenocles blamed the autumn fruit for different reasons. The one because it loosens the belly, and by emptying the body, is always producing fresh appetites. The other, Xenocles, said that most of the seasonal fruits, having something sharp and biting to the taste, summon the stomach to eating more than any relish or seasoning does. Indeed, even a little fruit brought to sick people who have lost their appetite restores it. Lamprias said that our own connatural heat, by which we are naturally nourished, is in summer dispersed and becomes weaker and more diffuse. But in the waning season, it gathers together again and grows strong, hidden within because of the chilling and condensation of the body. I, so as not to seem to contribute nothing to the discussion, said that in summer we become thirstier and use more liquid because of the heat. Now then, in the change of season, nature, seeking the opposite as is her custom, makes us hungrier, and gives back to the body's temperament its due of dry food in compensation. Yet one could not say that the food itself is altogether without a share of responsibility, coming as it does from young, fresh crops, not only cakes, pulses, bread, and wheat, but also the meat of animals that have fed richly on that year's produce. It differs from the old in its juices and draws those who partake and enjoy it on more strongly. On account of a certain dream, I was abstaining from eggs, taking great care over this so that, as in the case of Carr, the vision had often come to me clearly and repeatedly. This gave rise to a suspicion, while Sosius Senecio was entertaining us, that I was bound by Orphic or Pythagorean doctrines, and that I regarded the egg as some regard the heart and the brain as sacred to avoid, holding it to be a principle of generation. And Alexander, the Epicurean, brought this up in jest. It is the same thing to eat beans as to eat the heads of one's parents, as if men were hinting that eggs were beans because of the generation they involve, thinking there was no difference between eating eggs and making use of the very animals that lay the eggs. The defense against the charge thus became more unreasonable than the charge itself, for an Epicurean to speak of a dream. Hence I did not decline the reputation, while at the same time teasing Alexander a little in return, for he was in fact a charming and reasonably fond of learning man. Out of this, he drew into the middle the puzzle that is difficult and gives much trouble to inquirers, concerning the egg and the hen, which of the two came into being first. And Scylla, our companion, saying that with a small problem, as with an instrument, we were stirring up a great and heavy one, the question of the origin of the universe, declined to take part. But when Alexander laughed at the inquiry as bringing nothing relevant, our son-in-law Firmus said, "Well then, lend me the atoms for the present. For if the small elements must be posited as the origins of the large, it is likely that the egg came into being before the hen. For it is simple and uncompounded, as among sensible things, whereas the hen is more varied and mixed. And in general, the origin comes first, and the origin is the seed, and the egg is more than seed but less than an animal. For as growth and progress seems to be a mean between natural talent and virtue, so the egg is a certain progress of nature toward the ensouled, proceeding from the seed. Further, just as in the animal they say that arteries and veins come into being first, so it stands to reason that the egg, too, came into being before the animal, as the container before the thing contained. For the arts, too, first mold shapeless, unformed things, and only later articulate each into its proper shapes. As Polyclitus the sculptor said, the hardest part of the work is when the clay is under the fingernail. For this reason, it is likely that, since nature moves matter gently at first, the more sluggish matter obeys, producing shapeless and indeterminate impressions, like eggs, and once these are given shape and etched out, the animal is afterward fashioned within. Just as the caterpillar comes into being first, and then, having hardened through dryness and burst its skin, sends forth through itself another winged thing, releasing what is called its soul, in the same way here the egg pre-exists as, so to speak, the matter of the generation. For in every change it is necessary that what the changing thing changed from should exist earlier. Consider that gnats are engendered in a tree, and woodworms in timber, through the putrefaction or concoction of moisture. And no one would think it right that the thing generating them should not already be there beforehand, or should not be prior in nature. For matter stands in the relation to the things that come to be, as Plato says, of a mother and a nurse. And matter is everything out of which the thing generated has its composition. As for what comes after this, he said, laughing, I shall sing to those who understand the Orphic and sacred account, which declares that the egg is older not only than the hen, but, taking it all together, assigns to it the seniority of all things at once. And let the rest lie fair spoken, as Herodotus says, for they are more mystical matters. But since the world contains many kinds of living creatures, there is virtually no class that has no share in generation from an egg. It produces winged creatures and countless swimming and land creatures, lizards and amphibious ones, crocodiles and two-footed ones, the bird and footless ones, the serpent and many-footed ones, the locust. Hence it is not inappropriate that it has been consecrated among the rites of Dionysus as an image of that which generates and contains all things within itself. While Firmus was going through these points, Synesio said that the last of his images was the very first to tell against him. For you have unwittingly, he said, O Firmus, open the world against yourself instead of the proverbial door. For the world pre-exists as the most complete of all things, and it stands to reason that the complete is by nature prior to the incomplete, just as the whole body is prior to the maimed, and the whole prior to the part. For it makes no sense for there to be a part of something that has not yet come into being. Hence no one says that man belongs to the seed, nor the hen to the egg, but we say that the egg belongs to the hen and the seed to the man, on the ground that these latter come to be upon those, and take their origin in them, thereafter rendering the generation, as it were, as a debt owed to nature. For it is in want of what is its own, and therefore it is by nature disposed to want to make another such thing as that from which it was itself separated. And they define the generative principle as offspring in want of generation, but nothing is in want that has not come to be and does not exist. Eggs, on the other hand, are seen altogether to have the nature of something requiring, within some animal, a solidifying and composing, and organs and vessels of just such a kind, which is why no egg born of the earth has ever been recorded. Rather, the poets say that the Tyndarean egg appeared fallen from heaven. But complete and whole living creatures the earth even now brings forth. Mice in Egypt, and in many places snakes, frogs, and cicadas, once some other external principle and power has come into them. And in Sicily, at the time of the Servile War, when much blood and many unburied corpses had rotted away in the earth, a great swarm of locusts sprang up and, scattering everywhere over the island, destroyed the grain. These creatures then grow and are nourished from the earth, and produce a fertile residue of their nourishment, by which they turn to one another for pleasure, and, coupling in intercourse, some are naturally disposed to lay eggs, others to bear live young. And this above all makes it clear that, having received their first generation from the earth, They now, in a different way, produce their offspring through one another. And in general, it is like saying that the womb came into being before the woman. For as the womb stands in relation to the egg, so again the egg stands in relation to the chick, being conceived and delivered within it. So that there is no difference between the man who is puzzled how birds came to be if no eggs had come to be, and the one who asks how men and women came to be before there were genitals and wombs. And yet most parts come into existence together with the wholes. The faculties come to be added to the parts, and the activities to the faculties, and the results to the activities. And the result of the generative faculty of the parts is the seed and the egg, so that they must come later than the generation of the wholes. Consider, too, that just as it is not possible for there to be concoction of food before an animal has come into being, so too neither can there be an egg nor a seed. For these two appear to come to be as the result of certain concoctions and transformations, and it is not possible, before an animal has come into being, for there to be a residue of an animal's food having the nature it has. Nevertheless, the seed does in some way lay claim to being a kind of origin, but the egg has neither the character of an origin, for it does not exist first, nor the nature of a whole, for it is incomplete. Hence we do not say that an animal has come to be without an origin, but we say that there is an origin of animal generation, by which matter first underwent change, a certain power having wrought a blending and mixture productive of offspring. But the egg is an afterproduct, like blood and milk, coming from the animal after nourishment and concoction. For an egg has never been observed forming out of mud, but has its composition and generation only within an animal, whereas countless animals form on their own. And why need one mention the rest? For though many eels are caught, no one has ever seen an eel possessing either milt or egg, yet if one draws off the water and scrapes out all the mud, once water flows back into the place, eels are spontaneously generated. It follows then that of necessity the thing that requires the other for its generation must have come into being later. But whatever can even now come into being apart from and without the other, this must be prior with respect to the origin of generation. For the argument concerns that first generation, since even now birds build nests before laying eggs, and women prepare swaddling clothes, yet you would not say that a nest came into being before an egg, or swaddling clothes before children. For it is not the earth, says Plato, that imitates woman, but woman that imitates the earth, and likewise each of the other females. For this reason, it is likely that the first generation from the earth, by virtue of the completeness and strength of that which generated, came to be complete and self-sufficient in itself, having no need of such organs, coverings, and vessels as nature now contrives and devises among creatures that bear young on account of their weakness. We were giving a victory banquet for Sossicles of Coronia, who had won as a poet at the Pythian Games. Since the athletic contest was drawing near, most of the conversation concerned the wrestlers, for many notable ones happened to have arrived. Lysimachus, one of the overseers of the Amphictyons who was present, said that he had recently heard some grammarian declare that wrestling was the most ancient of all contests, and that even its name bore adequate witness to this. For newer things are naturally apt to benefit from names already established among older ones, just as they say the pipe has been tuned. Harmostai, and call the pipe music, strokes, chromata, taking these names over from the lyre. So the place in which all the athletes train, they call the palaestra, wrestling ground, the name having first been won by wrestling, pale, and only afterward extended also to the other exercises later invented. I said that this piece of evidence was not strong. For the wrestling ground is named from wrestling, not because wrestling is the oldest of the other contests, but because it alone among the forms of athletic contest happens to need mud, dust, and oil, for men do not practice either running or boxing in wrestling grounds, but only the rolling that belongs to wrestling and to the pancration. For it is clear that the pancration is a mixture of boxing and wrestling. But otherwise, I said, how does it make sense that wrestling, being the most technical and most cunning of the contests, should also be the most ancient? For it is the simple and unskilled activities, accomplished by force rather than by method, that necessity brings forth first. When I had said this, Sossicles said, you are right, and I will contribute a proof to support you, taken from the name itself. For wrestling, pale seems to me to be named from Palawin, which is to deceive and throw down by trickery. And Philinus said, but to my mind, it is named from the wrestler's dust, palaist, for it is especially with this part, the palms, that wrestlers exert themselves, just as boxers again in turn use their fists. Hence the one is called pygmy, fist fight, and the other pale, wrestling from the deed itself. Moreover, since the poets, when they speak of sprinkling and dusting over, use the word palunai. And since we see that wrestlers make a special use of this, it is possible to bring the etymology of the name round to this point as well. Consider further, he said, whether it is not the case that for runners the task is to leave as much distance as possible behind them and to stand as far apart as they can, while the umpires do not allow boxers, even when they are quite willing, to come to close grips. Whereas wrestlers alone we see embracing and grasping one another, and most of the moves of the contest, thrusts, counter-thrusts, holds, and pressings, bring them together and intermingle them with one another. It is therefore not unclear that wrestling pale got its name from their coming especially near to and close pellas to one another. When this had been said, and we had praised Philinus for it, Lysimachus spoke up again. Which, then, would one say was the first of the contests, the foot race, as at Olympia? Here among us, however, in each event they bring in the competitors by age class. After the boy wrestlers, the men wrestlers, and likewise after the boy boxers, the men boxers, and the pancratiasts in the same way. But there, when the boys have finished competing, only then do they call in the men. Consider, though, he said, whether Homer does not rather demonstrate the order according to time, for in him boxing always comes first, wrestling second, and the foot race is always placed last among the athletic events. At this Menecrates the Thessalian, in admiration, exclaimed, by Heracles, how much escapes our notice. But if any of the verses are ready at hand for you, do not begrudge us a reminder. And Timon said, well, that the funeral games for Patroclus keep this order of events is, one might almost say, familiar to everyone. Maintaining the order consistently, the poet has made Achilles say to Nestor, I give you this prize outright, for you will no longer contend in boxing, nor wrestle, nor enter the javelin match, nor run on your feet. While he has made the old man, in replying, ramble on in the manner of the elderly, saying that he once beat Clytomnes son of Onops in boxing, and Ancaeus of Pleuron in wrestling, and outran Iphiclus on foot. Again, Odysseus challenges the Phaeacians either in boxing or in wrestling or even in running, while Alcinous, deprecating the contest, says, for we are not faultless boxers nor wrestlers, but we run swiftly on our feet, showing that it was not by chance, using whatever order happened to present itself differently at different times, but that he was following the customs then established and practiced according to convention. And it was carried out in this way because they still preserved the ancient order of these events. When my brother had finished, I said that the rest was truly stated, but that I could not think of the reason for the order. It seemed also to some of the others that it was not plausible that boxing and wrestling should have arisen earlier, in contest and rivalry, than running, and they urged me to bring the discussion to a higher level. I said offhand that all these seemed to me to be imitations and exercises of the arts of war. For the hoplite race is brought in after all the others, bearing witness that this is the goal of bodily training and of the contest, namely, that those who win, when they charge in against the walls, should be able to break through a section and cast it down. This is the meaning it carries, that there is no great benefit to a city in its walls if it has men capable of fighting and winning. In Sparta, moreover, for those who had won crowned contests, there was a special place in the ranks of battle, stationed around the king himself to fight. And among animals, only the horse has a share in a crown and in a contest, because it alone is by nature suited and trained to be present with fighting men and to campaign alongside them. But if this much has not been badly said, I went on, let us now consider that the first task of those fighting is to strike and to guard oneself. The second, once they have closed and come to grips, is to use pushing and to try to overturn one another, a maneuver by which, they say, the Spartans were especially overpowered by our men at Leuctra, since our men were skilled wrestlers. That is why in Aeschylus one of the warriors is called heavy, a wrestler in arms, and Sophocles somewhere says of the Trojans that they are horse-loving and horn-drawing, and with their bell-clanging shields, wrestlers. And indeed, in addition to all this, the third task is for the losers to flee and for the winners to pursue. It was fitting, then, that boxing should come first, that wrestling should hold the second place, and the foot race the last. Because boxing is an imitation of striking and guarding, wrestling of grappling and pushing, while by running they practice fleeing and pursuing. Soclarus, entertaining us in gardens encircled by the river Cephisus, showed us trees variously decorated with what are called graftings, for we saw olives sprouting up out of mastic trees and pomegranates out of myrtle. There were also oaks bearing fine pears and plain trees that had received apple grafts and fig trees with mulberry insertions and other minglings of plants mastered so far as to bear fruit. Now the rest of us were joking with Soclarus, saying that he was feeding stranger breeds and creatures than the sphinxes and chimeras of the poets. But Crato put before us for discussion the reason why only the oily plants are by nature unable to accept such graftings, for one does not see a pine cone, or a cypress, or a fir, or a pine nourishing anything of another kind. Philo took up the question and said, "There is a saying, Crato, current among the learned, confirmed by farmers as well. For they say that oil is hostile to plants, and that any plant you like would perish most quickly if drenched with oil, just as bees do. But the trees just mentioned have a rich and mature nature, so that they weep pitch and resin, and whenever they are struck at the cuts, as though from a wound, they gather a kind of discharge. Their pine torch wood, too, gives off an oily moisture and gleams all over with its unctuousness. And this is why they are hard to mix with the other kinds, just as oil itself is." When Philo had finished, Crato thought that the nature of the bark also contributed to this, for being thin and dry, it provides no seat or means of survival for the things inserted into it, unlike bark that is fleshy, moist, and soft, which clings by enfolding itself around the parts beneath the bark that receive the graft. Soclarus himself said that the man who made this point was not wrong to add that the receiving substance must be readily changeable in its own nature, so that, once overpowered, it may be assimilated and transform the nourishment within itself toward what is being implanted. For indeed, we first loosen and soften the earth, so that once broken up it may change readily and take hold of what is planted in it, for earth that is tight and hard is difficult to change. These trees, however, being light in their wood, produce no blending, because they are not overpowered and do not change. Further, he said, it is not unclear that in regard to what is being grafted, the receiving stock must bear the right proportion to it. The receiving part must always be, so to speak, female and fertile. Hence people choose the most fruitful of plants and graft onto them, just as they bring other infants to women who have abundant milk. But pine, cypress, and all such trees we see to be meager and poor in their fruit. For just as men given to excessive flesh and bulk are for the most part childless, because they spend the nourishment on the body and produce no seminal residue from it, so too such trees, enjoying their nourishment, all of it being spent upon themselves, thrive well in bodily size and grow, but bear no fruit, or if they do, it is small and slow to ripen. So that one should not be surprised if what is foreign does not grow in them, since even their own produce is poorly nourished in them. Carimonianus of Tralles, when all sorts of little fish had once been served, pointed one out to us, sharp-headed and elongated, and said that the remora resembled it. For he had seen one while sailing in the Sicilian Sea, and had marveled at its power, since it produced no small delay and holding back in the course of the voyage. The remora clinging on until it was caught by the ship's lookout, sticking to the outside of the ship's hull. Now there were some who laughed at Carimonianus for accepting a mythical and incredible fabrication, and there were others who kept talking of Antipathies, and there was much else one could hear from those present, that a ram's appearance stops a raging elephant, that if you bring a sprig of oak near a viper and touch it with it, the viper freezes still, that a wild bull grows calm and gentle when tied to a fig tree, and that amber moves and attracts all light things, except basil and things soaked in oil, and that the lodestone does not draw iron if it has been smeared with garlic. Since the evidence for these things is plain, they said it was difficult, if not altogether impossible, to grasp the cause. I said that this was more an evasion of the question than an assignment of the cause. "Let us consider," I said, that many incidental features attaching to conditions get credited, wrongly, with being causes, just as if someone thought that the grape of the vine ripens because of the flowering of the chaste tree, on the ground that, as the saying goes, the chaste tree blooms and the cluster ripens. Or confuse the mold that appears on lamps with the clouding over of the surrounding air. Or supposed that the curving of the nails was the cause, rather than a mere accompaniment, of an ulcer around the internal organs. Just as then, in these cases, each such occurrence is a byproduct of the condition, arising from the same causes, so too, I said, there is one cause why the ship both sails slowly and draws the remora to itself. For when the ship's hull is dry and not very heavy with moisture, it is likely that the keel, slipping along by reason of its lightness, cuts the wave with clean wood and parts from it easily. But whenever the hull, being very wet and soaked through, draws to itself much seaweed and mossy encrustations, the cutting edge of the wood becomes blunter, and the wave, striking against its stickiness, is not easily thrown off. That is why they scrape the sides, cleaning off the moss and seaweed from the wood, the very things to which it is likely that the remora, clinging by reason of the stickiness, is mistaken for the cause of the slowness, rather than being a mere accompaniment of the cause that produces the slowness. As for wolf-torn horses, some said they were named from the wolves' bits, lycospatae, because their high spirit and unruliness were curbed in this way. But our father, who is in no way given to offhand claims in such matters of common report, and who always kept the finest horses, said that colts attacked by wolves, if they escaped, turned out good and swift-footed, and were called lycospatae, wolf-snatched. Since a good many people bore witness to this for him, it presented a difficulty as to the cause why this incident makes the horses more spirited and fierce. Most of those present held the view that the experience produces in the horses not spirit but fear, and that, becoming easily startled and quick to panic at everything, they acquire impulses that are sharp and swift, like animals struck by a snare. I said we ought to consider whether the truth is not the opposite of what seems the case, that the colts do not become swifter runners because they escaped the harm of the wild beasts after being attacked, but rather that they would not have escaped at all unless they had by nature already been spirited and fast. Just as Odysseus did not become clever by escaping from the Cyclops, but escaped because he was already such a man. After this, the question was raised about wolf-bitten sheep, which are said to yield the sweetest meat, but wool that breeds lice. Patroclus, my son-in-law, seemed to make no poor attempt at explaining the sweetness, on the ground that the beast's bite renders the flesh tender, since the wolf's breath is so overheated and fiery that it melts and softens even the hardest of bones within its belly. Hence, too, wolf-bitten flesh putrefies faster than other meat. As for the wool, we were puzzled whether it does not actually breed the lice, but rather attracts them, distinguishing the flesh by some roughness that irritates or by a peculiar heat, and that this power is engendered in the wool in relation to the wolf's bite and breath, as it spreads even to the hairs of the animal being slaughtered. And the historical record lent credence to the argument. For we know that of hunters and butchers, some fell an animal with a single blow, so that what has been struck lies without another breath, while others kill only with difficulty and after many blows. And what is more remarkable still is that some inject, along with the iron blade, such a force into the wounded creature that it putrefies quickly and does not last even for a single day, while others, killing no more slowly than those, produce no such effect on the flesh of the slaughtered animals, which instead lasts for a long time. That the changes attending the slaughter and death of animals extend as far as the hides, hairs, and nails. Homer, too, is accustomed to make clear when he speaks, concerning hides and thongs, of a thong, from an ox slain by force. For in animals not undone by disease or old age but by slaughter, the hide becomes taut and firm, whereas creatures bitten by wild beasts have their nails turn black and their hair fall out, and their hides grow flaccid and ragged. When I held the eponymous office at home, most of our dinners were feasts, with a portion allotted to each person by lot at the sacrifices, a practice which some found altogether admirable, while others, finding fault with it as unsociable and illiberal, thought that as soon as the garland was set aside one ought to go back again to the customary manner of dining, rearranging the tables. For it is not for the sake of eating, said Agis, nor of drinking, but of drinking together and eating together as I think that we invite one another. But this division into portions, doing away with the sharing, makes many dinners and many diners, but no one a fellow diner with anyone else, whenever each person, as if from a butcher's table, takes his portion by weight and sets it before himself. And yet what difference is there between setting down a cup and a jug of wine, filled before each of the guests and a separate table, as the Demophontidae are said to have done for Orestes, bidding him drink without paying attention to the others, and what actually happens now, setting out meat and bread so that each feasts as though from his own manger. Except that we are not, as it happens, bound to silence as those who entertained Orestes were. But perhaps this very thing, too, invites those present toward a common sharing with one another, in that we make use of common conversation with one another, and of song, and share alike in the delight of a girl playing the harp and a girl playing the flute. And this mixing bowl here, set in the midst with no fixed limit, is an unstinting spring of good fellowship, and it has a measure of enjoyment fitted to each man's desire, unlike the portion of meat and bread, which, most unjustly of all, prides itself on an equal measure applied to unequal people. For the same amount is more to the man who needs little and less to the one who needs more. So, my friend, just as a physician who doles out equal doses of medicine to many patients, measured out precisely by weight, is utterly ridiculous, so too is a host of the sort who gathers people together who are neither equally thirsty nor equally hungry, and then attends to them all from an equal supply, defining what is fair and fitting arithmetically rather than geometrically. Now when we go to a shopkeeper, we all make use of one and the same public measure. But when we come to dinner, each of us brings his own private belly, which is filled not by an equal amount, but by a sufficient one. We ought not to transplant those Homeric feasts here, out of the military messes and camp dinners, but rather to emulate the humanity of the ancients, who honored fellowship not merely as sharers of hearth and roof, but as sharers of the same measure and the same food, holding every form of community in esteem. As for Homer's dinners, let us bid them farewell, for they are half-starved and thirsty affairs, with kings as their stewards more exacting than Italian innkeepers, so that even in the thick of battle, with the enemy at hand, they keep precise account of how much each of their diners has drunk. Pindar's feasts, I suppose, are better, in which heroes, mingled reverently around the table again and again, through sharing everything with one another. For that was a true blending and commingling, whereas this present practice is a separation and estrangement of men who are supposed to be the closest of friends, as if they could not even share a common dish. When Hages had one applause for these remarks, they urged me on to attack him. So I said that Hages was suffering nothing out of the ordinary, if he grew vexed at receiving an equal share while carrying so great a belly, for he himself was one of those who delighted in gluttony. Since in a common fish there are no bones, as Democritus says. But that, I said, is precisely the point, and it is what has brought upon us a portion beyond our fair share. For nothing has as great a need of equality, which, as the old woman in Euripides says, binds city to allied city and ally to ally, as does fellowship around a table, which has this need by nature and not by convention, and it is a necessary need, not a novel or imported one due to opinion. To the man who eats more than his share of the common food, whatever falls behind and is left out becomes an enemy, just as in the surge of a fast-sailing trireme. For I do not think that suspicion, snatching, a contest of hands and elbowing are a friendly or convivial prelude to a feast, but rather uncouth and dog-like, and they often end in abuse and anger, not only against one another, but even against the table servants and the hosts. As long as Fate and Lachesis presided with equality over fellowship at dinners and drinking parties, nothing unseemly or ungenerous was to be seen. Indeed, they called the dinners themselves datas, feasts, and those who were entertained datamons, feasters, and the table servants datr, from the verb to divide and to distribute. The Lacedaemonians had as their meat carvers not just anyone, but their foremost men, so that even Lysander was appointed meat carver by King Agesilaus in Asia. It was then, I think, that fair distribution fell out of use, when extravagance crept into dinners. For there was, I suppose, no need to divide up pastries and honeyed cheesecakes and other spiced sauces and all sorts of relishes and side dishes. But men, overcome by their fondness for delicacies and soft living, abandoned the principle of equal shares. A proof of this account is that even now sacrifices and public dinners are still conducted by portion, on account of the simplicity and cleanliness of that way of life, so that the one who takes charge of the distribution at the same time helps preserve its frugality. But where private property exists, is common fellowship thereby destroyed? Only where there is no equality. For it is not the possession of what is one's own, but the seizing of what belongs to another, and the greed that arises over the common good, that has given rise to injustice. And it has given rise to strife as well, which the laws, by stopping it with a boundary and measure on private possession, have become known by name as the source of authority and power that distributes fairly to the common good. Why, the host does not think it right to distribute even a garland to each of us individually, nor couches and places at table. But if someone comes bringing a mistress or a harp girl, the goods of friends are common, so that, in Anaxagoras's words, all things may become one together. But if the separateness of these things in no way disturbs our fellowship, seeing that the greatest things and those most worthy of our concern, conversation, toasts, tokens of friendship, are held in common, let us stop dishonoring the fates. And let us stop dishonoring, too, the lot which is fortune's child, as Euripides says, fortune, which assigns the first place neither to wealth nor to reputation, but carried along now this way, now that, as chance will have it, both puffs up and exalts the poor and humble man, letting him taste a measure of independence, and by accustoming the rich and great man to equality, tempers him without pain, so that he does not grow peevish. Simonides the poet, my dear Sosia Senecio, once at a certain drinking party saw a stranger reclining in silence and conversing with no one, and said, "Sir, if you are a fool, you are doing a wise thing, but if you are wise, a foolish one. For it is better to hide ignorance, as Heraclitus says, though that is hard work when one is at ease and over wine. Wine which lets loose even a very thoughtful man to sing, and unleashes him to laugh gently and to dance, and it sends forth a word that were better left unspoken." Heraclitus here, it seems to me, is pointing out the difference between mere wine drinking and drunkenness. For song and laughter and dancing come upon men who are moderately in their cups. But talking and saying things that would be better left unsaid is already the work of intoxication and drunkenness. That is why Plato thinks that the characters of most men are best seen in wine, and Homer too, in saying that they had not yet come to know one another even at table, clearly understands the talkativeness that wine induces and its power to generate much conversation. For there is no getting to know one another among people who eat and drink in silence. But because drinking leads on to talking, and in talking, along with the stripping bare of much that would otherwise lie hidden, drinking together affords a certain understanding of one another, so that one might not unfairly rebuke Aesop. "Why, my good sir, do you go looking for those windows through which one man might see into another's mind?" It is wine that opens us up and shows us, not letting us keep still, but stripping away our pretense and our studied posture, since these are as far removed from wine's law as a child is far from its tutor. For Aesop, then, and for Plato, and for anyone else who needs a method of testing character, unmixed wine is useful for this purpose. But those who have no need to put one another to the test or to catch each other out, but only to enjoy each other's company kindly, bring together such problems and topics of conversation when they meet, by which the base parts of the soul are concealed, while the best and most cultured part takes fresh heart, advancing, as it were, toward pastures and meadows that are its own, led on by the love of learning. That is why we too have composed for you this third set of 10 table talk questions, beginning with the one about garlands. For a discussion about garlands once arose, and the drinking party was in Athens, when Erato the musician had made sacrifice to the muses and was entertaining a good many guests. For after dinner, garlands of every kind were being passed around, and Ammonius made some jest at our expense because, instead of the laurel, we had bound ourselves with garlands of roses. saying that flowery garlands in general were girlish and more fitting for young girls at play than for gatherings of philosophers and musical men. "I am amazed, too," he said, "at this Erato here, who abhors chromatic shifts in melodies and accuses the good Agathon of them." Agathon, who is said to have been the first to introduce the chromatic scale into tragedy, when he was training the chorus for his Mysians. Yet he himself, as you see, has filled our drinking party with a variegated wealth of colors and blossoms, shutting out luxury and soft indulgence that comes in through the ears with his pipe music, while ushering into the soul. As though through other doors, the luxury that comes through the eyes and the nose, and making the garland an instrument of pleasure rather than of piety. And yet this very perfume, from this flowery and already withering garland in the hands of the garland weavers, gives off a more serious fragrance than one might expect. But pleasure that is bound up with no useful purpose and does not follow upon the origin of a natural desire has no place at a drinking party of philosophically men. For just as those who are led to dinner by friends who have invited them enjoy, by a humane custom, the same hospitality, as Aristodemus was led by Socrates to the house of Agathon, who was giving a feast, whereas if a man comes of his own accord, the door ought to be shut against him. So too the pleasures connected with eating and drinking, invited by nature and following upon our appetites, have their proper place, while it is fitting that all other pleasures, uninvited and indulged for no reasonable purpose, be dismissed. At this, the young men who were unaccustomed to Ammonius's manner grew troubled and quietly began loosening their garlands. But I, knowing that Ammonius had thrown out the argument into our midst for the sake of exercise and inquiry, addressed Tryphon the physician. "My good sir," I said, "you are bound either to lay aside with us this fine garland blazing with roses, or else to tell us, as you are accustomed to do on each occasion, what benefits flowery garlands bring toward drinking." Erato took up the reply and said, "Yes, for it has been decided that we should accept no pleasure without some contribution in return, but should grow peevish in our enjoyments unless we suffer this along with some compensating benefit. As though we rightly view perfume and purple dye with suspicion, on account of their added extravagance, calling them, in the words of the barbarian, deceitful garments and ointments. While natural colors and scents have a simplicity and purity about them, and differ in no way from fruit. For surely, it would be foolish to gather and enjoy fruits, which nature gives us, and yet to dishonor the scents and colors that the seasons bring, on account of the pleasure that blossoms upon them and their charm, unless some other useful purpose is brought in from outside as well. Indeed, quite the opposite seems to be the case. If nature has made nothing in vain, as you philosophers say, then these very things seem to have been made for the sake of pleasure, since they have no other useful purpose, but are by nature suited only to give delight. Consider that, in plants that grow and put forth shoots, the leaves come into being for the preservation of the fruit, so that the trees, warmed and cooled by them, may bear the changes of season in moderation. But the flower, once it has served its brief time, is of no further use, except that, when we make use of it, it provides us something delightful to smell and to see, giving off wondrous scents and unfolding into a variety of colors and hues beyond imitation. That is why, when the leaves are torn away, the plants seem, as it were, to feel pain and to be wounded, and a kind of festering injury and unseemly baldness comes upon them. And it is not, it seems, only of the laurel that Empedocles says one must altogether keep the hands from its leaves. But we ought to spare the leaves of all other trees as well, and not adorn ourselves through the disfigurement of those trees, plundering their leaves by force and against nature. But the taking away of flowers is more like a harvesting, and does no harm at all. Rather, even if one does not gather them in season, they wither and fall away on their own. Just as barbarians clothe themselves in the hides of their flocks instead of their wool, so it seems to me that those who weave their garlands more from leaves than from flowers make improper use of plants. For my part, then, I contribute these arguments to the garland sellers, for I am no scholar, so as to be able to quote poems in which we read of the ancient victors at the sacred games being crowned with garlands of flowers. Only I do recall that the rose garland has been especially proclaimed sacred to the muses, remembering Sappho's words to some unmusical and ignorant woman: "You will lie dead, and no memory of you will remain, for you have no share in the roses that come from Pieria. But if Tryphon too can offer some testimony from the art of medicine, let us hear it. At this, Tryphon took up the argument and said that the ancients had been careless about none of these matters, inasmuch as they made the greatest use of medicine derived from plants. And there are proofs of this still evident even now. The Tyrians bring first offerings to Agenor's son, and the Magnesians to Chiron, who are said to have been the first to practice medicine. For there are roots and herbs by which they used to heal the sick. And Dionysus was reckoned a moderate physician, not only because he discovered wine, the most powerful and most pleasant of remedies, but also because he brought ivy into honor, as a plant whose power is most opposed to that of wine, and taught his revelers to wear it as a garland, so that they might suffer less from the wine, since the ivy's coldness quenches the drunkenness. Some of the very names of plants reveal the ancients' careful attention to these matters. They named the walnut tree Caria, because it gives off a heavy and stupefying vapor that causes pain to those who recline beneath it, and the narcissus, because it dulls the sinews and brings on a numb heaviness, from which it takes its name. That is why Sophocles called it the ancient garland of the great gods, meaning the gods of the underworld. They say too that rue paganum was named from its power, for it fixes pregnancy, the seed through dryness by means of its heat, and is altogether hostile to pregnant women. And those who suppose that amethyst was so named for its power to help against drunkenness, both the plant itself and the stone named after it are mistaken. For each of the two is named from its color, since its leaf is not the color of unmixed wine, but resembles wine that is wineless and watered down in its blend. But there are countless other examples one could cite, in which their properties gave rise to their names, and those already mentioned are enough to show the diligence and wide experience of the ancients, from which they made use of garlands worn at drinking parties. For above all, unmixed wine, when it takes hold of the head and strains the body's organs of sense, throws a man into confusion. And the vapors given off by flowers wonderfully help against this, walling off the head from drunkenness as though it were a citadel, since the warm ones gently relax the pores and give the wine's fumes room to breathe, while those that are mildly cool, by their moderate contact, drive back the vapors rising upward, as does the garland of violets and roses. For both are astringent, and by their scent, contract the heaviness in the head. And the flower of henna, and crocus, and bicarus, bring those who have been drinking into an untroubled sleep, for they give off a smooth and gentle emanation that gradually dissolves the bodily irregularities and roughness that come with drunkenness, so that, as a calm sets in, the and the after effects of drunkenness are digested away along with it. When the scents of certain flowers spread upward around the brain, the passages of the sense organs are cleansed, and the fluids are gently thinned, without shock or agitation, being separated out by the warmth, and the brain, which is cold by nature, is warmed. This is why, above all, people called the flower garlands hung about the neck hypothymides, and anointed their breasts with the perfumes made from them. Alcaeus bears witness to this, urging that myrrh be poured down over the head that has suffered much and over the gray-haired breast. So from here too, the scents shoot upward, drawn by their heat into the brain through the sense of smell. It was not because they thought that spiritedness, thymos, was encamped in the heart that they called the neck garlands, hypothymides. For on that reasoning, it would have been more fitting to call them epithymides. But rather, as I say, because of their exhalation and fumigation. Let us not be surprised that the exhalations of garlands have such power. It is reported that even the shade of the yew kills people who fall asleep beneath it, when it is at the height of its flowering, and that the vapor given off by the poppy has caused those who gather its sap without taking precautions to collapse. As for the herb called alyssum, some are freed of hiccups simply by taking it in hand, others merely by looking at it. It is also said to be good for flocks of sheep and goats when planted around their folds. The rose, presumably, gets its name from the great stream of fragrance it gives off. That is also why it withers so quickly. In its power it is cooling, though in appearance it is fiery red, not unreasonably, for a thin layer of heat blooms on its surface, pushed outward by its coldness. When we had praised this, Ammonius, smiling at Trypho, said it was not right to kick apart, by way of rebuttal, a discourse so varied and flowery like a garland. Except that ivy, I don't know how, has been woven in among the cold things, said to help quench undiluted wine. For it is actually fiery and rather hot, and its berry, when mixed into wine, makes it more intoxicating and disturbing precisely because it heats it up, and they say that its tendril, when pulled, twists just as wood does in fire. Snow, which often lingers for many days on other plants, melts away from ivy fastest of all, or rather it is destroyed and melts around it altogether at once, because of its heat. But the greatest proof of this is reported by Theophrastus. When Alexander ordered Harpalus to plant Greek trees in the parks of Babylon, and above all, since the region was fiery and scorched, to introduce grove-loving, leafy, shady plants among the vegetation, the land refused to receive ivy alone, though Harpalus went to great lengths and struggled hard to make it take. But it died and dried up because, being fiery itself, when mixed with a fiery soil, it found no proper blending but was thrown out of its natural state. For excesses destroy their own powers, which is why things instead reach out for their opposites, and the cold loves the warm, and the warm loves the cold. That is why mountainous, windy, snow-covered regions produce the resinous, pitch-bearing plants above all pines and firs. But apart from these, my dear Trypho, plants that are chilly and cold shed their leaves, because their small and feeble store of heat withdraws and abandons the plant, whereas oil and heat keep the olive, the laurel, and the cypress evergreen, just as they keep the ivy.